cosa leggerai? Con calibro affascini il tuo cuore.
So pleased because Joan Price is returning to this program for part two. She was on last week, and Joan Price is on a mission. Older folks don't need to give up on their sexuality, but no matter your age, please continue to listen to this program because we older folks can offer you wisdom and perspective. Right, Joan Price?
Right. Sex has no expiration date.
I love the way you put that. No expiration date. And last week we talked about not giving up on sexuality, and we also talked about how people stay sexual even when they don't have a partner. And you offered some easy tips for arousal, whether partnered or alone. And going on these journeys of exploration are such a good thing, because I can tell you with my gerontologist hat on that gerontology, for listeners, I think most people know, but it's a study of aging, and my focus is on successful aging and sexuality, aging and sexuality. Anyway, remaining curious is a real important part, isn't it, Joan?
Curious. That's so good, Diana.
Yes.
Because so often we think, well, we've done all there is to do here, and we've been having sex with the same partner for in a long-term relationship for decades, and there's nothing new under the sun. Yeah, there is. Make something new happen. Stay
Make
curious.
Something new happen. Yes. And we thought we'd focus a little bit on, or perhaps a lot, on orgasm, because so many women have trouble with orgasm, no matter their age. Some older women feel that they've lost some of their clitoral responsiveness, and that may or may not be true. But you write about all of this and other sexual matters in your books, Better Than I Expected, Straight Talk About Sex After 60, and Naked at Our Age, Talking Out Loud About Senior Sex. And your most recent book, well, other than Ageless Erotica, which is wonderful, it's so sexy, you edited
Thank you.
That. But your most recent book, tell us just a little bit about that one.
It's the ultimate guide to sex after 50. Mm-hmm. And the idea of this book, I really thought I had said everything there was to say. I know all there is about sex now. No. There's so much more, because the kinds of questions that I get from my readers, from my followers, have made me delve deeper into, for example, what's going on medically, what can impact sexuality medically, both from medical conditions and from the treatments for those conditions, and many other things. How to spark up a relationship, or what if you're in a new relationship, or what if you're not in one at all? So what I did in this book is I wrote it really as a guide, as it says, a self-help guide, where you can find a lot of really valid information and helpful information about pretty much everything I could think of that might be affecting your sexuality. And there's a lot about how to, if you're interested maybe in fantasy and kink and all these things that are not necessarily physiological, along with, of course, all the physiological things. I was trying to look at all the things that people say to me, I'm not getting aroused anymore, I'm not reaching orgasm anymore, I'm not interested in sex anymore, these things they bring up. And then if we look at what's going on around the person, what's going on inside and outside the person, there are so many things to address. Because as I think I said last week, everything impacts sex, and sex impacts everything else.
It really does. And if we go back to Masters and Johnson, the famous sex researchers from the late 50s and 60s, Dr. William Masters, who was a MD, said if things are going well in the bedroom, then things will go well in the living room.
That's very good. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, and it's so true, isn't it?
And it's similar to if your back hurts, nothing else works. Well, if your sex doesn't work, nothing else works. So
yeah,
it's very similar.
It's
true. So many things are involved.
Yes. And Joan, tell our listeners, because you do a lot of public speaking.
I do.
Yeah, so tell us about some of your recent, before we get into orgasms and maybe even dating while older, tell us about some of your public speaking and what people bring up. Are you noticing any themes when you speak, when you're out there speaking about senior sexuality in your books?
Yes, and I don't think I've ever told you about this, that I was in Montenegro speaking to an aging conference. The conference wasn't aging, it was about aging, attended by Russians.
Oh.
And I did that last year. It was fascinating because I thought, how alike or how different are we going to be? I'm talking to a Russian audience of mostly women, but not exclusively women,
yes,
over 50. Most of them seem to be between 50 and 70, though there are a few older. And I was speaking, I was having simultaneous translation going on, so it was like
mm-hmm.
being my own UN.
mm-hmm.
There were translators in a booth, and I would say something that I hoped was a joke, and there would be no laughter, and then 10 seconds later, everybody laughs. But
yes,
what I found is that we are more alike than we are different.
Mm-hmm.
I had been warned by the organizers of the conference. They said to me, Joan, the people need the information you have. We don't have access to it anywhere, and you're going to be giving us a lot that's new. And please don't expect that people will ask questions because they're not used to talking about sex. We're not seen as sexual beings over 50. So don't expect anyone to ask questions, but know that your information is being received.
That is
they
fascinating.
Asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
They asked questions. Lots of questions. They asked questions during the session, after the session. They followed me after that. They found me at breakfast and said, we've been talking about this all night.
Uh-huh.
It was so rewarding to realize that here I was helping people who really did not have access to this information or didn't know where to find it. They could find it if they knew where, but they didn't at that point. And they were so eager for it. And they asked pretty much the same questions that Americans ask.
For example,
my husband can't get an erection and doesn't want to tell a doctor. What do I do?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
That's a very common question.
In the mood for sex anymore. I don't care about it anymore. I used to like it, but I don't now. What do I do? Or my husband left. I don't have a partner. I still feel sexual yearnings, but I don't have anyone to do it with. So what do I do? And
mm-hmm.
These are the same things I hear from Americans,
same things, of course.
I hear in Minneapolis or New York City.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. So we have, there's some universality, and that can be reassuring. Just the parallel example is that's why group work can be so powerful. For 7 years, many years ago, I co-led two women's sexuality groups,
mm-hmm.
and all of these women had sexual trauma in their backgrounds, and most of them at the beginning of the group weren't able to reach orgasm. But there was a lot of power in the group work because the universality, well, I'm not alone. Other people have experienced some of these feelings. And I'm sure that was a powerful part of your presentation in Russia. That,
yes.
Yes. And how wonderful
you,
that you got the word out.
There was one question that won the prize of the question I have never heard before but really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a woman. She stood up and she said, I am a tailor. I make clothes. I can look at a woman and see exactly by the fit of her blouse what I would need to change. Can you look at us and tell what our sex problems are?
And, wow, that's a powerful question. So how did you answer that?
I said, hi, no, I can't. And everybody went, ha.
Ah.
And she's very relieved. And I said, but I sure wish I could.
Yeah, they wanted you to be a mind reader and or a body reader.
Well, they were fearful that maybe I was, that maybe something showed, just as the cut of the blouse showed what was inferior about it.
Yeah. You know, in general, you can tell very old ladies if they look a little more like wrinkled apricots and they have a certain expression on their face, I'm generalizing a little bit, they're probably not remaining sexual.
Oh, I don't think we can tell anything from looking.
You don't think so?
Mm-mm. Nope, absolutely not.
All right. Well, I disagree with you a little bit, but
oh, that's okay.
That's okay. You know, it's I just think that when a woman remains sexual, either with herself or with a partner or both, that there is a certain sort of sexual glow. I pick up on it when I'm in groups, and.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just
from
my experience.
I think you're right. If you are interacting on that deeply intimate level with people, there's something that is revealed just in their body posture and in the facial expressions and in their eyes, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I'm saying if somebody just walks by on the street.
No, you're right. You can't tell from that.
I was once... I was at a book fair in, I won't say where it is because I'm going to say something a little weird about them, but it was in an area that is frequented by affluent seniors.
Uh-huh.
And I was at a book fair and people were walking so far away to avoid interacting with me.
Oh, my
it really
goodness.
Surprised me. And at one point, one woman came to me. She looked like she was probably 80.
Uh-huh.
She was wearing a black leather miniskirt, really miniskirt. She had her hair dyed black, lots of makeup on, long polished nails, and she looked like a siren. And she said, I want nothing to do with sex anymore. And then she turned around and left.
Boy, I understand your position because she certainly wasn't putting that out there, was she?
Right. She was putting out there hot to trot.
Exactly.
Not.
Yes.
She was probably really just trying to signal youth.
Signal youth. Oh, yeah. And
which
perhaps
is sad to me because I...
Sad, yes.
I embrace aging.
Yes, I know you do. And I do, too, and that's one reason we have good, lively conversations.
Yes.
Yeah, so how do you embrace aging, and just in general, and then we'll get into some specifics that we thought about for areas of discussion for this program.
Well, in general, I'm not doing anything to alter my... appearance. I mean, I'll try to look, make myself look good in what I wear and my demeanor, but I've stopped coloring my hair. I stopped that, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, and I like it. I like the moonbeam hair.
Mm-hmm.
I have never done plastic surgery. I have nothing against people who decide to do it. It just is something where I think if I have a reputation for authenticity, and that's what I stand for in everything I speak about.
Yes, you do.
then why not just embrace that fully? I say, okay, yeah, here you got this wrinkly person in front of you, and I'm talking about sex. I also, when I have companies that try to advertise on my blog, I do accept advertisers on my blog, nakedatourage.com, but they are only companies that I fully endorse, that I know that I endorse, I like what they're doing, and that they embrace my mission rather than just wanting my audience to buy from them. Mm-hmm. And I often turn down advertisers because they're promoting something anti-aging.
I'm so glad. I'm not surprised you do that. And I'm really glad you do it because it certainly maintains your authenticity and what you believe in.
I don't want anything associated with me to be promoting anti-aging.
All right.
And I tell them, you know, I'm pro-aging. And they said, oh, well, I know what you just mean, but the way you're saying it is shaming aging.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not on that ride with you.
Right. Yeah, there is, and of course there's a big commercial market out there for shaming aging and and getting people to take steps to and spend a lot of money to, like the senior lady who might have been 80 who came up to you in her black leather miniskirt and trying to be an 80-year-old siren, but also who didn't want anything to do with sexuality. So
right.
There's...
And I'll bet she complains to her friends, there are no good men to date around here.
Oh, I'm sure.
I
am sure.
The only one thing, and I don't want anything to do with it. I don't know why she's getting these guys that think we can have sex.
Yeah. Yeah. So, your books are just so wonderful and informative and give permission for older people to be sexual. And a lot of older people do need that kind of permission.
Yes, and I also am sometimes under fire because I've been accused of promoting kink, promoting polyamory, promoting swinging. I'm not promoting anything. I'm just saying that whatever it is that you want to do that does not hurt anyone is fair game, and look at what it is you want. Not what society tells you you ought to want.
Right. Yeah, and we know all of the health benefits of remaining sexual. And in your book, Naked at Our Age, Talking Out Loud About Senior Sex, you get advice from different experts. Well, I'm actually in that book, too.
And you're in it.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's 2011 when it was published, yes.
I think it came out in 2011 and it won awards in 2012.
Yes, that sounds right. So, you have advice from expert Ellen Barnard on page 139, reasons to keep your sexual self alive and functioning, and this will enable us to talk about the importance of female orgasms. And she says you'll be maintaining good pelvic floor health.
Mm-hmm.
That is really important. Expand on that a little bit, and I will too, because I'm a big believer in pelvic floor health.
The pelvic floor muscles are those internal muscles that contract during orgasm. I mean, they're used for other things too, but they contract during orgasm. And if they are not used, they can either go slack and not have the ability to contract, or they can go the other way. They can stay contracted and lose the ability to relax. And neither of those is what we want.
Exactly.
And for example, a lot of older people have trouble with incontinence. starts out with you cough or laugh and pee a little. And can get worse from there. It may just remain at that, or it may get worse from there. But did you know that orgasms are a good way to make sure that that does not develop into full incontinence?
Yes, I do know that. And I also, just as an aside, I read that the number one reason that older women decide to live in assisted care living or retirement community is because of urinary incontinence.
Oh, how sad.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's the number one reason, and I guess...
That's also one reason why women stop having sex.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. I think that's right.
I don't know where where the number is on the hierarchy, but I personally hear from women who say, I don't dare have sex because I'm afraid I'm gonna pee.
Right.
And so there are, you know, a good pelvic floor therapist is essential in a situation like this. And most people don't even know that pelvic floor therapists, that they exist. These are people who are specially trained. They're physical therapists, but they are particularly trained in that pelvic floor area. And they can diagnose what is going on if there is either pelvic pain or slackness or whatever it is that might be disturbing you. They can have many different kinds of minimally invasive tests that can diagnose what the problem is and then help you with what you need. And sometimes the problem could be an infection, or it could be that you need to do particular exercises for the pelvic floor muscles. They may be Kegels, they may be a different kind of exercise. But this is a whole world that nobody talks about or knows about, maybe because it just deals with that area of the body. I don't know.
Yes,
pelvic floor therapists work with men, too.
Well, I was just going to say, they work with men, too. And and men who have had prostate surgery may have some difficulty with urinary incontinence, at least initially.
And they may have pain with orgasm, too.
And they may. That's right. And pelvic floor therapists, and I work with a number of them here in the Seattle and the Pacific Northwest, because I have a number of women with vaginismus who for our listeners, that's where there's the contractions at the vaginal opening are such that penetration isn't even possible. But these pelvic floor therapists are trained in all kinds of things about down there, and for men and for women, and they can be very helpful. And it can make such a difference. Unfortunately, not all areas in the United States, and certainly not in the world, have pelvic floor PTs with this sort of training. California certainly does. When I worked in Los Angeles, I worked with PTs there, and collaborating with these doctors and these PTs are really helpful.
You do such good work, Diana. I hope people appreciate you.
Oh, thank you, Joan. How sweet of you.
I mean, you have other people on the show, and you're singing their praises, and I just don't know whether the people who listen are aware of what a shining light you are in the sexuality world.
Oh, what a sweet thing for you to say. Well, I remain in this field because it is so deeply satisfying. You and I are a similar age, and I, probably like you, have no intentions of retiring. Your work is deeply satisfying. My work is deeply satisfying. You're making a difference. I'm making a difference. Why would you retire? And by the way, that's back to when I said remaining curious helps us with successful aging, but also certainly staying engaged in life and making a difference. Doesn't that help too?
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're
Joan,
combining.
Thank you for that compliment. You're very sweet. I don't think I've ever had a guest say that.
Really?
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Silly guests.
Well, no, but you have a certain consciousness and awareness, and we're both seniors, and we both appreciate sexuality, and we both are involved in the field and in different ways. But yeah. So
you were asking about my speeches before. Do you know that I'm doing webinars now?
Yeah, talk about that. That'd be great to hear.
I can't get on a plane for every area I want to reach with my message and with my information. Mm-hmm. So I've started doing webinars so that people can, if your listeners don't know what a webinar is, it's like an online class. It's live. I'm here at, say, noon on Saturday, and I've got my webcam on and my microphone, and I'm set up. And if you purchase a ticket to my webinar, then I send you the link and the password for it. You get on your computer at the same time, and there it's like you're in the online auditorium listening to my presentation. And if you can't make it at the time I'm doing it live, it's kept as a recording so that you can watch it at a different time. So that's letting people from other countries, for example, attend. If they say, well, no, I'm not going to do it at that time, but send me the link and the password. Here's my fee for the ticket, and I'll watch it when I can.
And that's excellent. That's excellent. So how would people, would they go to your website and then you give them instructions and how
they go to my website and they'll see an invitation to subscribe to my newsletter. And that's where I'm announcing everything I'm doing. That's probably the simplest way. There are other ways to access it, but that's the simplest. If you go to either joanprice.com, my static website, or my blog, nakedatourage.com, you'll see the subscribe or the sign for Joan's mailing list. And if you just click that and fill out a form, and the reason for the form is that we want to know that you are actually subscribing and the no robot is just putting in your email address. And then you'll get that information. I just did one. I did 7 steps to reclaiming your sexuality. And it went so well, I might just repeat that one as well as doing a couple of others. I'd like to get a series going to do when I'm not traveling. And then I will feel I can reach more people, and more people who maybe live somewhere I'm never going to visit anyway will get to get that information too. Some people learn by reading. Some people learn by listening.
That's true. That's very true. So when I did a review of our show last week, I put up there your eepearl.com.
Oh, good. That's the mailing list link. Great.
Right. And so I'm hoping, and I'll repeat that because that's a way that people can access. I mean, webinars, yes, it's very current and good for you because as a senior, of course, it's required for your work, but you're really on top of all these tech things. I totally depend on my fiance Brian to do. He posts the shows and he was in charge of my website about 3.5 years ago. It got improved, and I'm just not very good at this. But you're on top of all this, Joan.
Well, some of the things I love learning anyway, so some of it I just learn. And other things where if someone else would do a much better job than I would, then I hire that person to help.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have a Brian.
Yes.
I wish I had a Brian.
Oh, I know.
For many reasons, that would be really lovely.
Yes. You know, I honestly, Joan, I so often count my blessings because I know that a lot of older women don't have a partner. And I got very lucky because I, as you know, but some listeners may or may not know, I met Brian through Match.com 6.5 years ago, and it just was, the algorithms worked because we are very compatible, and we have stayed compatible, and we're really good partners. But a lot of women don't have a partner, and maybe this is a good segue, because I do want to spend a little time talking about orgasms, and certainly women can have orgasms. It's an important for them to have it, with or without a partner. And you have a wonderful phrase, track the tingle. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could sort of define that as a way to begin to talk about female orgasm.
Yes. By track the tingle, I mean that there are different times during the day where we might be feeling more susceptible to being sexually aroused or less. And many people don't realize that we're not the same from morning to night, that our sexual desire, our arousability, ebbs and flows during the day. So what I suggest is that people just track that for a couple of days, just throughout the day and evening, say, is this a time that I could really get sexually aroused if all these things were working, if I had my sex toy charged, or if I had time to go to my bedroom right now, or if if my partner were available. And after a couple of days, you'll see a pattern emerging, that there's a certain time that is really good for you, and other times where not at all. So once you know what I call your tingle time is, if you track the tingle being that ooh feeling that sort of courses through your body that says, this would be a really good time. So once you know when that is, schedule your sex dates with yourself or your partner for those tingle times.
And
you will find that if you have sex during that time, you will be more easily aroused, and it will be easier to reach orgasm.
Yes, and I've heard you say that sometimes exercise can help with
absolutely
getting more blood flow to the genitals.
Yes,
maybe half an hour
right before
sex.
Well, and just as close to the sex time as possible, because that's going to increase the blood flow.
Yeah, and you know, I find in my practice I also have to explain to some of my older men who are taking a PDE5 inhibitor, Viagra, Cialis, whatever, and their urologists fail to tell them that they should not be having a big meal, because then the blood is involved with digesting food.
Digestion.
And not, you know, blood going to the genital, in the case of a man, to his penis. The same is true for a woman. You can't, you want the blood to be going to the genitals.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, and
so eat later.
What? Yeah, eat later, right.
Sex.
So, you're in your book with the expert advice. So by having orgasms, Alan Bernard said that you'll maintain good pelvic floor health. We've talked about that. And I thought this was an important piece, too. Your risk of depression will be reduced. People who enjoy 1 to 3 orgasms per week reduce their risk of mild to moderate depression by 30%.
Yes.
And that's really important, because a lot of older people, well, of any age, depression is a risk.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. And one of the problems, too, is if they're taking medications for depression, that can reduce the sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a vicious cycle there. You're depressed, and you're taking meds for depression, and you're not having sex.
Yeah, the SSRIs are terrible. They interfere with orgasm for men and for women, for sure.
But there are some that work better than others, and it's the individual. What might work for you wouldn't work well for someone else, and vice versa. So what we need to do is go to our doctors and say, sex is important to us, and
right.
This is interfering with my sexual function. So what can we? What else can we try? What can we do instead? I'm not going to accept that I'm not having orgasms.
Yeah, and too many people fail to communicate that to their doctors. And one medication that seems not to have the sexual side effects is Wellbutrin. But so many of the others do have sexual side effects, not only lowering the libido, but interfering with expressing orgasm.
Yes. People often don't realize that their pharmacist can be a real ally.
Oh, that's
this.
A good point. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
That, you know, when you go to pick up your medications, there's this place for consultation.
Right.
You can just request a consultation.
Yeah.
And then tell the pharmacist what's going on. The pharmacist is likely more knowledgeable about the sexual side effects of these drugs than your doctor even is.
Right. That's right. Yes, too many doctors are not informed quite enough about sexuality, and I think patients pick up on this and will not ask their sexual related questions. They feel intimidated, or and of course as a therapist I hear all kinds of really sad stories from clients who said, well, I've tried to bring this up, you know, an older person, 65 or so, and
mm-hmm.
tried to bring this up with my doctor, and he said, well, have a glass of wine, relax, you know,
totally
dismissive, minimizing the problem.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the doctor is saying, in effect,
aren't you cute for thinking you can have sex?
Yeah, and you're aging, and it's part of aging, and,
yeah.
you know, and why should you be having sex when you're an older person? Oh, don't you get incensed about that? I do.
Yeah, I do. Well, you know from The Ultimate Guide to Sex After 50 that I have a whole chapter on you and your doctor, how you talk to your doctor, how you fire your doctor.
Yeah, and yes.
It's important.
It's
important. We need to be extra vigilant that the doctors don't demean us or that leave us feeling, mm-hmm. oh, well, I guess that was a stupid question. No, it's not a stupid question.
No, that's right.
We have the right to our sexuality all the way through our lives.
Right. That is so true, and you and I are on that bandwagon, but too many others are not, and finally medical schools are giving a little more classroom work, a little more education about human sexuality.
More than 1 hour?
It used to be one hour. It's ridiculous. They're
and
getting
none of
a little
that was
more than that.
Especially yeah. about aging.
Right. That's exactly right. And human sexuality was not taught in any medical school until at all, even 1 hour worth, until 1962.
Uh-huh.
The University of Minnesota Medical School.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So a lot of, and then of course you have doctors who are very uncomfortable with their own sexuality, and they don't, that plus lack of education makes it difficult to have conversations.
They're sometimes just feeling inadequate. They don't want to encourage the questioning because they know they don't know the answers.
Mm-hmm.
So it behooves them to not only get educated themselves, but to create a referral list of people in the community that are doing the work, the pelvic floor therapists, the
mm-hmm.
Oncology assistants that specialize in sexuality, all these different areas that we're going to need in our lives.
Yes,
find out
right.
who those people are. You know where you can often find referrals if your doctor doesn't have it? Your local education-based sexuality shop.
Oh, say more about that. I don't know about that.
So what I mean by education-based sexuality shop, there are sex shops that just have you know, sticky floors and dark rooms. I'm not talking about
those. I know what you're saying. Okay, like
I'm talking about
Lovers or Or Babeland, or...
That's right. The ones that are clean, brightly lighted, either right. women-owned or women are made to feel safe and welcome there. And they usually have classes, so they are education-based.
That's
Their
right.
staff is really well-trained. And if you walk in there and you say, my doctor doesn't know who the pelvic floor therapists are in this city, they do.
Yes, you're right. You're right. And I've been impressed in general with how well-educated they're usually young female salespeople. And I've sent a number of my clients, including some older clients. I remember one couple, both of them about 65, about to go on a cruise together. And their sex, they came to me because they wanted to help their sex life come alive again. And so I said, well, you need to go to Babeland up on Capitol Hill, which is nearby here. And they were so embarrassed to do it. But I said, you know, the sales ladies are really good and really well-educated, and they'll tell you whether it's a vibrating cock ring or a vibrating dildo or a good sex toy for the clitoris. They'll tell you. And
is absolutely right, but I would mm-hmm. steer you away from genderizing that. It isn't just the women who do a good job.
Yeah, but don't you think that mostly they're mostly female salespeople in those sex shops?
No.
Mm-mm. Oh, well, maybe
no,
it's
I'm
different
thinking
in California.
Of Good Vibrations and Smitten Kitten, and there are all kinds of genders that are working there and are knowledgeable. And you don't have to, let's say you want something for your clitoris, you don't have to wait for a woman to be free. This is what people are, they're all trained in this, and this is what they do all day long.
Well, that's a very good point, Joan, and I'm sorry, maybe Seattle is different, and maybe I haven't gone into a sex store recently, although I did attend an educational thing at Babeland here, and I didn't see any men in terms of the
sales. Well, Babeland might have all women staff, I don't know, in your area, but mm-hmm. I'm thinking of some of the shops that hire me to speak, and they certainly, it's not divided by gender, and there are more than two genders.
Yes. No, of course, that's right. So then, going back to the advantages of having orgasms, your immune system, this is from your book,
mm-hmm.
your immune system will get a boost. People who enjoy 1 to 3 orgasms per week have a reduced incidence of colds and other viruses.
Isn't that interesting? I have no idea why, but it seems to work out that way. And there's no good reason not to have orgasms.
Mm-hmm. I think that one possibility, I mean, we don't really know, but when we have orgasms, we have more nitric oxide.
Mm.
And nitric oxide helps with, because it expands some of our cells. I may not be saying this right physiologically, but so it can cut down on inflammation, which for older people is a big risk.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, I've always said that having sex and having multiple orgasms is like a fountain of youth. It's just amazing.
Mm.
And your risk of heart disease is even decreased.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So,
and pain is reduced if you have pain from
reduced.
Any kind of source.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so we talked last week about how if you don't have a partner, you need to set the scene for it and for self-stimulation. And so we talked about that last time, but just making sure that you say to yourself, I deserve pleasure.
Yes.
And it's for my overall well-being and for my good health.
Yeah.
And I'd rather have a partner, but if I don't have a partner, I'm going to keep myself vital.
Yes. Just create a good fantasy to go with that.
Yes. And there are no mind crimes.
Ooh, nice. Well said. Those are your words, not mine, right? They're very good.
Well, the mind crimes comes from Carl Frankel. I've interviewed him, and I like it because some people get all kind of guilty about, oh, this fantasy is sort of kinky or weird, and I say, well, you know, whatever turns you on, and you don't have to share it with anybody.
That's right. See, what turns us on is always unique, and we don't have to waste our time saying, I wonder why I like that idea, because it doesn't matter why. It just, mm-hmm. just is. And you also don't have to feel, oh, my gosh, does that mean I really want to do this thing that I would never do in real life? No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean that at all. It means that the fantasy about it is a turn-on for you, that's all. Totally
yeah.
harmless. You're not going to turn into someone you don't want to be because you happen to fantasize about something that you would really not want to do. Or maybe it is something you would want to do, but might or might not ever happen. None of that matters. What happens in your mind stays in your mind.
Yes, and I don't even think there's a lot. If you have a partner, there isn't necessarily benefit in sharing the fantasy, unless you want to act out a fantasy. And, of course, you talk about that in your books. That can be fun.
Role-playing it, yes.
Role-playing, right.
But I often suggest that you don't share a fantasy unless mm-hmm. you're really sure it's going to go over well. One way to test it out is if you had a book of erotica, such as Ageless Erotica, and your fantasy happened to be one from one of those stories. And you
yes.
could have your partner read that and say, you know, this story really, I really liked this story. Would you read it too?
Right.
And then if he reads it and says, oh, my God, is that disgusting, you don't have to talk about it anymore.
That's right.
But if he says, I really like that too. And so you may have some more things to talk about. So don't just blurt out a fantasy because you're into sharing. You know, I'll share mine if you'll share yours.
Yeah.
I wouldn't suggest you could do it for that reason.
I totally agree with you, and it gets some people in trouble with their partners.
Yeah.
I mean, if we go back to the 70s, we have Nancy Friday's book. What was the title? It was all about, My Secret Garden.
Yes, I was thinking something with a garden. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that book is still in print, and I think it was published in 73, 74.
I think that's when I read it. I'd have to reread it.
Yeah. Anyway, one of the things that she noted was that women who had rape fantasies certainly did not, in real life, did not want to be raped.
That's right.
But they kind of liked the fact that a man would overpower them and they didn't have to take responsibility for their sexuality.
Well, they liked the fantasy of it.
Right.
They might never want to be with a man who would do anything like that.
Right.
Or even that would be dominant. They might not even want a dominant partner. But they
mm-hmm.
might, in a fantasy, just like mm-hmm. to be just submitting to an overwhelming lust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No problem with that. Whatever's happening in your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
If it works, then glory hallelujah.
I know. Yeah. And a lot of older people who find themselves in a new place. They're maybe newly widowed, or they're divorced, separated, divorced. They're kind of scared about dating again. How can I date again at this age?
I give a 3-hour workshop on that.
Yeah. So before we run out of time, let's talk a little bit about. What do you call it? DWO. Dating while older, right?
Dating while older, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's so much to say. You can. I don't know how to narrow it down since I do a 2 to 3 hour presentation on this. And I might be doing that in a webinar, too. So
oh, good.
If any of your listeners sign up for my newsletter and in the comments session say, want the dating webinar, please, I'm thinking of giving that one, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's so much about it. Dating changes so much, and some of us hadn't dated for 50 years, and now here we are on a totally different dating scene with totally different rules and opportunities, and how do you meet someone? Do you have to do online dating, and how do you take rejection? How do you meet somebody? When does it get to sex? Do we really have to use safer sex? See where I'm going? There's so much involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a whole chapter on that in The Ultimate Guide to Sex After 50. That would be a good starting place. But one thing I'm going to suggest for any people who are listening who are in that situation where they're going, okay, I need to get out there, but what's the first step? The first step is figuring out what you're looking for, who you are, and then how are you going to match those two things? Too often we want to meet someone, and that someone is so nebulous. And so we meet a lot of people that aren't right for us at all, or we don't meet anyone. But if we just really narrowed it down, and I suggest making a list in three columns, one column for the non-negotiables. The person I'm looking for needs to have these qualities or these attributes. And the second column is this would also be nice. This isn't an absolute deal breaker, but this would be nice too. And then the third column is as long as I'm asking. And these are the maybe whimsical things that you think, well, I'd give bonus points for these. I wouldn't send anyone away who didn't have them or do them, but I would give bonus points. I know I'm going quickly on that just because it's a process. But when the way I came up with that three column list is that I discovered in going through old journals years ago when I was with Robert and I was thinking, as many of us do, I've got to get rid of my old journals because I don't want anyone to find them and read them and know what I did and thought up to this point. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've had that experience. So I'm reading through my old journals, and I find an entry from when I was in my 30s where I was saying, where is the man I really want to be with? And I made these lists, 30 qualities. And would you believe that my Robert had every last one of them?
I do believe it. That was the love of your life. And for the listeners, we've done a show on this in the past, but for listeners, your Robert died of cancer in 2008, yeah. So, but isn't that something that in your 30s, you wrote a list?
Yes, I was already looking for him.
Mm. And then he appeared and you recognized each other.
Yes.
And
I recognized him. He took a while to understand he was looking for me, too.
Yes.
I knew him right away. But he, well, that story is in Better Than I Ever Expected.
That's right.
Dance teacher, and he thought that was the line you didn't cross. So here I was chasing him so hard, and he was just, that's the line you don't cross. He didn't tell me that. He just pretended he didn't know that I was chasing him. It was really funny when we look back.
Well, I think it's what you're saying is important, that we have to get really clear on what we want.
Yes.
And then we can move toward it once we get clear about that. We can move toward it. And, for instance, Brian, after his divorce, and he was married for like 32 years, and I came to Match.com as a widow, but he worked with a therapist, and he decided the things that he really wanted in a woman. He got really clear. And one of the things that he really wanted was a woman without drama, without too much drama.
Ah, that's hard to find, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And there had been his former wife with a fair amount of anxiety, so he didn't, he really wanted somebody easygoing. But he got really clear about what he wanted. He also wanted a woman who really liked sex, and check, 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 so.
And it's fair to put that on your list.
Yes, that's right, yeah. But we move toward what we visualize.
That's right, that, we do.
That's a kind of a Buddhist idea, but I think it's very true. And I think it's remarkable that you made this list in your 30s and that you saved the journals. I hope you didn't dispose of them. I hope you still have them.
I never did dispose of them.
Good.
I decided against it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I it was in my 30s, and then I didn't meet him till my 50s.
So yeah.
About 20 years, and I think of him as wending his way slowly towards me.
Yeah. Oh, Joan, I feel for you that, because he's probably a really difficult act to follow, because he was such an amazing man. Yeah.
I miss him still. I miss him with every breath.
Yeah.
But I also realize, with a lot of really good counseling from grief therapists, and I recommend that so much, that what I got from our relationship, what he taught me, how he made me feel loved, how he enabled me to express all the love that was in me, that's something I can carry with me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. He gave me that. He didn't take it away when he died.
Yeah. So how he enabled you to love even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I got some of that, too, from my late husband, who was such a loving man. And it helped me get ready even for Brian, because you talk about carrying it through.
I'd like to give an assignment to your listeners who are in a relationship now.
Good. Let's do that, and that'll be probably the final thing, because we're coming close to the top of the hour. So what is your assignment,
Joan? Write a love letter to your beloved saying all the things that you value about this person, what you love, why you love the person that way, and then what would you wish for that person if you weren't in the picture anymore?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Robert did that for me. He knew he was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote me one of these letters, and I treasure it. It's one of my most valuable, it's just the treasure of my life that I have that letter from him.
Yeah, and that's such a generous, loving thing to do, too.
Mm-hmm.
To say what you wish for your beloved after death.
That will make it so much easier to move on, because nobody's going to say, and I don't want you to ever look at another person after I die. Everyone's going to say, I wish you find love again. I wish you live fully. Be the person that I know you to be.
Yeah.
Don't be sad. Move past that into joy again. We're all going to wish that for someone that we love deeply. And just having that in writing, having something like that in writing, will help, if you go first, will help your beloved move through grief.
Oh, you say it so well and so authentically. I mean, this comes from your life experience, and that's profound. And Joan, I do thank you for returning to the program for part two, and we'll do it again. We won't wait. Well, you know, maybe 6 months, something like that.
Always available to talk to you, Diana.
Thank you, Joan. You're a very precious woman. Great resource. All right, goodbye, everybody. Happy feet.